their housing is, or because of where their schools are. Recently, I've been reading about something called redlining, and it talks about how, you know, residences of, you know, black and brown communities, they were marked red because they were, this is historically, because they were a high risk for mortgages. So meaning that communities of black and brown people, they weren't able historically, you know, to, they weren't able to get housing that is safe for them, or housing in safe spaces, in healthy, you know, spaces that we could see having more, you know, more parks, or
Vanessa,
you know, more.
The show is ending. I want to thank you so much for being with us again. Vanessa Nakate has just written a new book. It is called A Bigger Picture.
You're listening. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to sound like a broken record, but you are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Listen sponsored. Now, become a member now. Become a member not only because everything you hear is straight, everything you hear is the late, everything here is great, but we also want you to become a member because we want you to get in there and put your shoulders next to the wall like we're doing. Help pay some of them electric bills, some of our toilet papers, our napkins, our portable plates, portable knives and forks. But better than that, even for the staff, the guys are working hard here at KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And this is Screaming Jay Hawkins telling you why you got to do it. You got to do it not because it's an order, not because it's mandatory, not because it's a must, but it's because this is the only place where you're hearing the right stuff. You're hearing the truth, you're hearing the good sound, and you're digging people who knows what it's all about. So pick up on a few things and lay down some of them other things and just dig KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. And remember, I said so. I, Screaming Jay Hawkins. I ain't walking, I'm talking. I'm squawking. Become a member now. Become a member of KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM on your dial. I'm about to sign off. Bye.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO radio station is located in Portland, Oregon, in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuya, and many other indigenous nations of the Willamette and Columbia River regions. It is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationship to each other and the living world. We establish and support harmony within ourselves and set the stage for practice.
The following program is a special encore rebroadcast for these unique pandemic times. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred and are no longer relevant.
We'll be right back. Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, a special on COVID-19 and mass incarceration. People in prison are extremely vulnerable to the deadly virus and are being severely impacted by it. The United States currently has the largest incarcerated population in the world, with about 2.3 million people in jails and prisons across the country, according to the Prison Policy Initiative. More than half of them, nearly 1.3 million, do not have the ability to socially distance or take the sanitary measures needed to slow the spread of COVID-19. In prisons, jails, and immigration detention centers, there's very little diagnostic testing. The effects of cramped and unsanitary cells and the lack of testing have been disastrous in prisons across the country. In April 2020, prisoners and prison staff in several states, including California, New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and others, have reportedly been infected by the virus. And in some cases, many have died. One Ohio prison recently found that more than 70% of inmates are positive for COVID-19. This according to NPR. Women, especially impoverished single mothers, are the fastest growing sector of the prison population. Today, you will hear audio from a recent webinar entitled COVID-19, Decarceration and Abolition. It focused on how we can achieve decarceration. It explains what decarceration is and how it can be achieved for the millions of people in jails, prisons, and immigration detention centers across the country. The webinar was hosted by Haymarket Books. You will hear the presentation by Ruthie Wilson Gilmore. Ruth Wilson Gilmore is a professor of earth and environmental sciences and director of the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the City University of New York Graduate Center. She is a co-founder of California Prison Moratorium Project and Critical Resistance. She is author of the prize-winning book, Golden Gulag, Prisons, Surplus, Crisis, and Opposition in Globalizing California. Her forthcoming book, Change Everything, Racial Capitalism and the Case for Abolition, is the inaugural book in the new Abolitionist Papers book series, which is edited by Naomi Murakawa. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Prices for U.S. consumers shot up in November, 6.8% compared with last year. It's the biggest increase in 39 years. Surging costs for food, fuel, housing, and other items are to blame. The Labor Department also reported today that from October to November, prices jumped 0.8%. Inflation has been intensifying pressure on consumers, especially lower-income households, and particularly for everyday necessities. It's also negated the higher wages many workers have received, complicated the Federal Reserve's plans to reduce its aid for the economy, and coincided with flagging public support for President Biden. Economists have pointed to factors like the rapid rebound from the pandemic, recession, supply shortages at factories in the U.S. and abroad, and bottlenecks at U.S. ports. A British appeals court has ruled that WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange could be extradited to the United States. The High Court in London overturned a lower court that found Assange's mental health was too fragile to withstand the American penal system. A judge earlier this year refused a U.S. request to extradite Assange to face spying charges over WikiLeaks' publication of secret military documents a decade ago. The judge said the Australian hacker would likely attempt suicide if held under harsh U.S. prison conditions. The appellate court ruled today that U.S. assurances were enough to guarantee Assange would be treated humanely. Assange's legal team plans to appeal. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on Thursday recommended booster shots of Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine for 16 and 17-year-olds who are 6 months past their second shot. The move clears the way for vaccinations to start. The recommendation comes amid a surge in infections nationwide due to the Delta variant, as well as uncertainty about the newly discovered Omicron variant. The CDC's announcement came just a few hours after the Food and Drug Administration granted Pfizer an expansion of its emergency use authorization to bolster protection against the Delta and the emerging Omicron variant. President Biden will close his two-day virtual summit for democracy today by shining a spotlight on election integrity, countering authoritarian regimes, and bolstering independent media. On the summit's first day, on Thursday, Biden announced plans for the U.S. to spend up to $424 million around the world to support independent media, anti-corruption work, and more. Christina Onestad reports.
The president also announced he was launching an initiative to spend up to $424 million for programming around the world that supports press freedoms, anti-corruption work, and more. More than 100 nations were invited to take part, as well as human rights groups and advocates. Attendees included leaders from Denmark, Ghana, New Zealand, South Korea, Zambia, Amnesty International, the NAACP, and the United Nations. The summit drew backlash from adversaries, Russia and China. Their ambassadors to the U.S. wrote a joint essay describing the Biden administration as exhibiting a Cold War mentality that will stoke up ideological confrontation and a rift in the world. I'm Christina Onestad, reporting for KPFA.
President Biden will attend a private service today for former Kansas Senator and Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole today at Washington National Cathedral, and a public one at the World War II Memorial a day after Dole lay in state at the U.S. Capitol, where Biden and top leaders from both parties saluted the wounded World War II veteran. Conservationists are urging California to prioritize protecting coastal wetlands as part of the state's fight against climate change. Public News Service's Suzanne Potter reports.
Dozens of groups have sent a letter to the head of the California Natural Resources Agency asking for action to protect existing wetlands and near-shore areas and restore those that have been degraded. Gilly Lyons with the Pew Charitable Trusts is among those who signed the letter.
The request from the signers is to protect biodiversity, to store and sequester carbon, and to mitigate the effects of climate change that we're already living with.
The letter comes during the public comment period for a draft of the CNRA's new Natural and Working Lands Climate Smart Strategy to be finalized early next year. Last year, Governor Gavin Newsom issued an executive order requiring state agencies to act to accelerate the natural removal of carbon and build climate resilience, especially in lower-income communities. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 90% of California's historic wetlands have been drained for agriculture and development over the past century. This is Suzanne Potter reporting.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are now going to go to COVID-19, decarceration and abolition. It was a recent webinar hosted by Haymarket Books. What is decarceration and what would it mean for the millions of people now in jails, prisons, and immigration centers across the country? The webinar was hosted by Haymarket Books. We will hear the presentation by Ruth Wilson Gilmore.
My dear friend Catherine McKittrick, who I think is listening from somewhere in Greater Toronto, recently cited the fantastic poet and lawyer M. Nurbeza Philip. Nurbeza said, "If we were truly all in this together, we would not all be in this together." And this is a message, I think, that we can use as our starting point in talking about COVID-19, mass incarceration, and the struggle for abolition. Mass incarceration and the related forms of detention that connect to it is a feature of places that have the deepest inequality, Now, this slide, which was created by the Prison Policy Initiative, perhaps the greatest data collection, visualization, and spreading organization in the United States and one of the great ones of the world, shows us that even in the context of the NATO, of NATO's founding organizations, the United States is off the chart, quite literally off the chart. And what holds this together? What holds together the possibility of mass incarceration in the richest country in the history of the world is a combination of organized abandonment, which is to say austerity, and organized violence, which is to say criminalization, policing, prisons, detention, deportation. Also look at images from the BRICS, that is to say from Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And we would see a similar pattern emerging where no one, no country is remotely close to the United States, but as Russia and other countries of the BRICS have followed increasingly neoliberal policies, which is to say the policies of organized abandonment, the policies of austerity, we see the number of people locked up rise and rise and rise. But as I said, the United States remains off the charts. That said, abolition actually is not a recitation of catastrophe or a culture of complaint. Indeed, catastrophe and complaint, if that's all we do, are the kinds of practices that induce in many people who are listening what my friend, the historian Daryl Scott, calls contempt and pity. And abolition is not looking for contempt or pity. What we are doing, rather, is this. We're trying in every possible way to find a way to politics that, rather than being distinguished by, as the sociologist and novelist Edouard Louis says, politics distinguished by style, we're looking for politics that really are grounded in the struggle over life and death. So Edouard Louis is a French, young French writer, and he wrote a fantastic book I recommend to everybody called Who Killed My Father? And it's in this book that he makes this distinction, politics as style as against politics as life and death. So what does politics as life and death mean for abolition? Well, abolition is presence. It's already happening in so many ways, in so many places around the world. And many of the people who are listening are already doing the work and are stumped, as many of us are, because so many of us are under some version of shelter in place / house arrest, and yet the work continues. Now, C.L.R. James teaches us that revolutions happen because people are so conservative. Conservative. He says they wait and wait and try every little thing until one day people come out in the street and clear up in a matter of years the disorder of centuries. Now, when Arundhati Roy says that COVID-19 is a portal, this might be the portal through which people who are doing all kinds of little things of various kinds around the world come out and clear up the disorder of centuries. My friend and comrade, Ayana Maria of Rust Belt Abolition Radio, lifted up a mention I made the other night of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense motto, survival pending revolution. And she thought and named a discussion that a few of us had on Rust Belt Abolition Radio the other day, that we could think of what we do as survival pending abolition. Survival pending abolition. So that means that the work behind and the work ahead is very, very long. I'll give you an example. In Los Angeles County, decades ago, the ACLU brought a conditions of confinement case against the county for the horrendous conditions in the jails. Over the years, the ACLU was in charge of taking care, keeping an eye on what the county did to remedy the horrific conditions. About 18 years ago, the ACLU invited a few abolitionists to come and talk to them about something they had never imagined, which was perhaps the way to remedy the problem with the LA County jails was not to have a jail at all, rather than to build a better jail. Slowly but surely, this way of understanding became central to the struggle in Los Angeles County over those jails. 16 years later, abolitionists who joined forces with the forces of reform managed to persuade the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors, one of the biggest governments by number of people in the United States, not to build new jails, but rather to put the billions of dollars that would have gone into that into housing, healthcare, and other life affirming projects. So abolition is long, abolition is presence. Abolition is how we connect with, form, grow from, and multiply organizations that have the capacity to lift the movement. I learned from Vijay Prashad many years ago that our main work, we who are talking heads sometimes on Skype, our main work is to lift the movement, not to lead it, to lift it. To lift it by showing how anti-domestic violence people are central to the formation of abolition. As a movement, that mutual aid organizations, which are now flourishing everywhere because of the emergency of COVID-19, that unions, food, healthcare, nurses, building trades, all of these organizations have become, in one way or another, connected with the movement in the direction of abolition, because abolition is about abolishing the conditions under which prison became the solution to problems rather than abolishing the buildings we call prisons. There are faith organizations, neighborhood organizations, artists organizations, tenant organizations, prisoners organizations inside and out, libraries, environmental justice, legal aid, transit workers, rights advocates, public health advocates, bail funds, you name it, large and small, all of these people are coming together in various configurations around the world to try to relieve the stress of organized abandonment and its realization as through organized violence by changing the world in which we live. So that is the big picture that connects inequality with abolition and mass incarceration. The pandemic is focusing everybody's mind. There's nothing like fear to focus the mind. And the fear has many, many aspects to it, and therefore the responses that people are putting together are in many ways quite astonishing. For example, just to take one very pointed case. Some people, I think mostly students at New York University Law School, put together a sheet, a guide for all of the state jurisdictions and the Federal Bureau of Prisons in the country to show who actually has the authority to release people so that people who are organizing on the ground could focus using this power map on those who could in a brief amount of time, make the decision to release people. What we know about mass incarceration is that it is class war. And it is, as class war, very tightly knotted to the vulnerabilities that the types of organizations I listed a few minutes ago and the kinds of organizing they do are trying to relieve. Labor unions are trying to relieve certain kinds of vulnerabilities, as are housing advocates, as are prisoner rights advocates, as are people who are incarcerated who are advocating on their own behalf, families, communities, and so forth. We could spend some time, perhaps, thinking about the fact that in the United States, over the period that mass incarceration has become this catch-all solution for a wide array of social, economic, behavioral, and other problems, the number of prison beds has gone up as the number of hospital beds has gone down. That the movement in the opposite direction is quite startling to me. And as many people have pointed out, those who are against and those who are for, the configuration of hospital and healthcare in the United States today, we still see the fact that many, many areas of the US are underserved, if served at all. Places that have the capacity to take care of people are overwhelmed because of cuts to hospital and healthcare. And the workers who are working in hospitals, working in transportation, working in all of the sinews of the system to try to keep people whose lives are in danger from becoming sick and dying are struggling with inadequate resources when the resources could be there. So, what can we think about in terms of organizing now? Certainly, a lot of the work that many people have done concerning rural workers' vulnerabilities should and can be lifted up now. Whether we're talking about the MST in Brazil and the landless workers who have been organizing for years, both to have access to land, to produce food and well-being, and to live and have shelter, but who have also built an enormous educational program for themselves and others that has very strong international connections throughout this hemisphere and indeed around the world. Or in the US South, the Highlander Center, which in Tennessee since the 1920s has been a central place for organization, anti-racist, pro-working class organization. Similarly, when we think about housing, I can give a fantastic story about a young abolitionist artist called Sheena Griffiths, who's based in New Orleans. So after Katrina destroyed a good deal of everyday life in New Orleans, and then the anti-state came through and destroyed what hadn't already been destroyed by the floods and the rot, Shana and some of her comrades got together and said, we are going to create a housing trust so that a few households at least could have a safe, secure, and pleasant place to live. So they knocked themselves out learning how to make a trust, how to take land out of the market, found the place they wanted to buy, raised the money to buy the place, did all of this, all the paperwork. And when they were finished, what Shana Griffith had to say about it was, we did do this, we helped ourselves, and this tells me that the state we need is the one that will do this. We actually need that state that belongs to us, rather than think that we can do this ourselves for each other. We need the pro-state state, not the anti-state state. other possibilities with respect to COVID-19 connect with the various kinds of things that people are doing immediately to try to get people out of prison and jail, or to look after people who have gotten out who are vulnerable because they need shelter or food or other kinds of sustenance. So there are bail funds that have sprung up around the United States. They aren't new with COVID-19, but they are more urgently, of course, reaching out and raising money. We know that in Cook County, in Chicago, Shayla Grant and the comrades that she has been working with over the years have done an enormously wonderful job getting people out of Cook County jail. This is a good thing to do, and yet we also know that in the last 4 weeks, 22 million people in the United States lost their jobs. That means the need couldn't be greater for people to have the wherewithal to pay rent, to buy food, and so forth. There's less, as we say, discretionary cash available to help out with a bail fund. And therefore, like Shana Griffith discovered in the work that she did in New Orleans, we have to make demands on the social wage, which is our right and our requirement of ourselves. From around the world, there are examples of artists such as the Mulheres de Pedra in Rio de Janeiro, radical educators here in Portugal, Plataforma Gueto, the Detroit Justice Center, people who have been working with Mi Gente, working on behalf of undocumented people, long-distance migrants all over the United States, Copwatch in Frankfurt, disability organizers whose work has been so beautifully pulled together by Liat Ben-Moshe, people doing work on food, the Uptown People's Law Center, also in Chicago. Many of us with jobs, precariously employed, steadily employed or unemployed, who must join forces together rather than imagine that we can prevail by breaking ourselves up into smaller and smaller groups.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a quick station break. When we return, we'll continue the special presentation of COVID-19 and mass incarceration. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom.
Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website at sotrueradio.org. If you are a member of Facebook, you can look for us and like us there. We're also on SoundCloud. You can go to the search bar and type in Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott to find us. By the way, our handle on Twitter and Instagram is at SoTrueRadio. And in our tradition, we are going to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the great state of New Jersey. And internationally, we are going to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Switzerland. Now we return to COVID-19, decarceration and abolition, a recent webinar hosted by Haymarket Books. Ruthie Gilmore discusses what is meant by decarceration and what it would mean for the millions of people now in jails, prisons, and immigration detention centers across the country. The webinar was hosted by Haymarket Books. Let us return to hear more from Ruthie Gilmore.
we should always plan to win. And if we plan to win, we should ask ourselves, what happens next in the event of victory? And if what happens next in the event of victory is that the people who have been rightly released are the only ones who could ever be released, then we will not have won. Do I say leave people, everybody inside? Of course not. But I do say this. Most people who go to prison leave prison. Most people are not doing life sentences. There should not be any life sentences. And in most parts of the world, there aren't life sentences. But most people do leave prison. So rather than imagining that there is a magical line between less guilty and more guilty, or more innocent or more deserving or less deserving, or I will say violent and nonviolent, we should say, why not take seriously the fact that most people leave prison? Do a little bit of analysis to see that we could be closing prisons already and jails already if we just cut by 2 weeks and 3 weeks and 4 weeks, much less years, the kinds of sentences people are serving, and then move on to the work of undoing organized abandonment. As I, the example that I gave to you from Los Angeles County, this is not an impossible challenge. It did take a long time in Los Angeles. The next time shouldn't take as long. It shouldn't take as long because of what we learned. It shouldn't take as long because Los Angeles can model behavior that other polities can follow. Amilcar Cabral, who is one of the most important thinkers, organizers, leaders, revolutionaries of my consciousness, taught us, or cautioned us, I should say, against claiming easy victories. And he's absolutely right. That said, we should gather all of our victories and then stop and think about them and say, what is this victory going to make possible next? Why do these victories matter? Who have we abandoned? Who have we used our own capacity for organized violence against in order not to include them in victory? So I'll give an example from New York City. New York City plans to spend $11 billion building 4 new jails. This is the so-called Close Rikers Project. The mayor announced that the city budget, ravaged as it is by the effects of COVID-19, will shrink by $2 billion. $11 billion for prisons, $2 billion less for everything the city needs. This is really straightforward. The mayor can learn from Los Angeles County, do not build the new jails, close Rikers, use the resources, the money and human resources that would have gone into that entire array of carceral institutions that people would be organizing to close, just as people organized to close Rikers, which was opened because people organized to close the institution that preceded Rikers. The mayor and the city council can use the money for the well-being of a city that has indeed been ravaged by unemployment, ravaged by the highest number of deaths from COVID-19. How can that be? How can that be? Turning a corner has to happen now, because where life is precious, life is precious. A young organizer and thinker who has an entire story of his own to tell, called Micah Herskind, just published a piece in which he argues really beautifully about, you know, what is this high risk, low risk, no risk? There are humans, period. The late Randy Martin wrote a wonderful book about risk some years ago in which he said the world is under neoliberalism is dividing into these two categories. People who are risk, so they get locked up, and people who can bear risk, so they get mortgages. And we can see now with the economic collapse that is hastened by the kind of political leadership and normalized thinking, which is to say the domination, if not hegemony, of neoliberalism, tells us that where life is not precious, life is not precious, and that is the corner we have to turn. People look at me and say, oh, in the United States, she's Black. That means if she talks about racism, she's talking about what happens to Black people. Or they think, oh, that definition means Black people have it the worst. No. What that definition tries to do and seems to do for people as far in as varied places as Australia and Argentina and Mexico, Brazil, South Africa, many, many places where people have used operationalize that definition to try to think about what's happening in the world. What the definition helps them do is to think about the design of things, the design of relationships, whether the relationships be to jobs, to housing, to transportation, to health, to the justice system, to security in gender identity, to age, to vulnerability in old age and well-being as children. That this definition lets people start to think systematically so that it's possible to see how various groups come into being. Mm-hmm. Come into being and therefore then become naturally available for organizing and struggle. That's what that definition's for. So I'll give you some examples. The design of the public health system in the United States, and I think this is true throughout a good deal of the overdeveloped world, as well as a good deal of the world that, although dominated by resource extraction, still went through several rounds of governmental organization in the 20th century that put into place large-scale, complex governmental institutions designed to extract value from labor and land. So things like public health. Public health was such a project of elites in the 20th century. And so the design of public health, as we learn from people like Nayan Shah and Samuel Kelton Roberts and others, laid out a framework of care and disregard that itself has amplified over time, so that if today we say certain kinds of people are more likely to have underlying conditions that make them vulnerable to COVID-19 death, the issue is not, is there something objectively pathological about a person or a group of people, but rather how has the design of a public health system and the wherewithal to make it, to enliven it in practice, brought some people in and pushed some people out over time. Kenyon Farrow, longtime organizer, AIDS activist, economic justice activist, just activist, once upon a time critical resistance organizer, will be in conversation with Tamara Knopper, the visionary sociologist who is the best at thinking about data and thinking data visualization for the purpose of strengthening people and movements. And I want to say something else in thinking about my definition of racism, and that is that we must all beware bad statistics. As the statistical analyst and educator Ivory Toldson tells us over and over again, we have to beware of bad statistics and at the same time beware of the presumption that to recite vulnerability is somehow persuasive. If we say 50% of or 3% as against 1%, that somehow that's going to persuade people to action. That, in my experience, especially years ago when I was doing some outreach work with young people in high school who we were trying to kind of bring into the early days of critical resistance abolition, and I and others talked to a group of mostly brown and black young people, and one of their teachers said, well, 1 in 3 young black men is going to go to prison, right? Well, first of all, it turned out that statistic didn't hold any water. But let us even say it was true. What young person sitting in the auditorium in 1998 would be encouraged to listen and act if these scoldy older people came in and said, you are doomed. You are doomed. So to go back to what the purpose of my definition of racism is, the purpose of the definition is to enable people to think about collectivities whose vulnerability might then lead to joining forces in order to overcome that vulnerability and do something else. Example is water. Everywhere around the planet, people are struggling over water. So at the moment, on the Navajo Nation has become a hotspot for COVID-19, in part because of the scarcity of water. People can't do this simple thing we're all told to do, which is wash our hands. The Navajo Nation obviously brings to mind then the people who had organized at Standing Rock and the No DAPL pipeline people who have been trying to get people to understand that the anti-pipeline organizing has everything to do with protecting the land and particularly protecting water. So that struggle and the struggle that the vulnerability around inadequate water that produces likelihood of premature death connects the Navajo Nation with Flint, Michigan, and with Detroit, and the work that the Detroit Justice Center is doing with people in Australia, where especially after the fires of last year, the problem of adequate water and adequate nutrition is quite enormous. The fact that Cape Town, the city of Cape Town in South Africa, has been on the verge of running out of water for some time now, and so forth. So all of these concerns about water, thought through the lens of my definition of racism, I hope provide people with a sense of the opportunity to join forces to fight racism by fighting for water, to fight racism by fighting against prison, to fight racism by fighting for housing, rather than to fight against people's attitudes. I don't really care what anybody thinks of me as long as they stay out of my way. So let me talk a little bit about the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex. And it's really kind of interesting that we've gotten this far in our discussion, and I think had not said prison-industrial complex once, which is kind of great. So some of us, inspired mainly by Mike Davis and an article he published in The Nation in 1994, I think, maybe five, started to think about what we didn't yet call mass incarceration. So we started to think about how come there were so many people in prison, and how come there are so many new laws, and how come the sentences have gotten so long, and how come there are so many new prisons everywhere. So those were all the questions that animated us. Mike said, asked the question, is there a prison industrial complex? And in playing off the concept of military-industrial complex, he was inviting people to think about things that I even think he might not have thought about at the outset, which is to say, if we think about the military-industrial complex, we think not only about the people who go to war, but we have to think about the intellectuals who design the public policy that determines when the U.S., for example, will use diplomacy and when it will send troops. It means that the military-industrial complex means all of the people, engineers and designers and ordnance makers and so forth, who design the machinery of industrialized killing. And then the Pentagon that contracts for the machinery of industrialized killing to be made and made ready. The military-industrial complex includes all of the bases spread around the United States and around the world. Around the world. There are more than 800 U.S. bases around the world. It's not the only military around the world, but there is no military that has such a wide representation on the surface of the planet than the U.S. military. The military-industrial complex also includes all of the people who are, you know, residents of towns that are near bases, and the boosters who want to have more of the jobs that for civilians that come with the bases, and the people who work in the factories that make the ordnance and the bombs and so on and so forth. All of that is the MIC. And if all of that is the military-industrial complex, the people who make the laws, the people who make the, who design the policies, the people who design the weapons, the people who are actually uniform and civilian personnel, who enliven the whole thing, by extension, the prison-industrial complex has the same complexity, and that is not to muddy the water, but rather to clarify that there are all these different places to fight. That we can fight in rural America, where people, in many cases, welcomed new prisons, thinking the prison was going to bring jobs and save their rural hospital. Neither thing happened. Or the people who imagine that the only kind of future they can have as first-generation college students is to major in criminal justice of one kind or another and hope to become a police officer or a prison guard or a worker in that environment rather than a teacher or an artist or something else that the same amount of education could produce. Uses of land, uses of resources, uses of money, and relationships between and among people are all involved in prison industrial complex. So that's a long way, long wind up to saying abolition really does require that we change one thing, which is everything, which is what the title of that book is about, everything. So there are some young from my point of view, I just turned 70, but some young lawyers, legal scholars, and also practicing lawyers, including a young woman who's doing a postdoc at Cornell, who have been doing all kinds of legal work in the various hot zones of the so-called war on terror around the world for a long time. For example, in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border and in the Horn of Africa and elsewhere. And this one particular young lawyer, Zora Ahmed, said, I think that the principles of abolition, as I have come to understand them through the combination of Insight Women of Color Against Violence, put together with critical resistance, gives us the basis for thinking about how to take abolition into the most difficult struggles outside of prison and detention, which are the struggles from ground to the air of hot war and the complexities of those struggles. That, as she put it, it's not as though we can say there's a drone which is bad and everyone on the ground is not. Rather, all of these relations have gotten so messed up over time that we have to sort them out, and that is the way to sort them out. So yes, abolition does, in a word, extend to war. There is so much mutual aid that extends across the barriers of occupation, of war, of struggle, that goes in both directions. So it's not as though people in the United States are exclusively in the position to offer help, that people who are in the occupied territories are exclusively in the position to require help. I don't think that that is the way to think, and I know for a fact that that's not how things have gone. So for example, during the very, very active days in Ferguson, Missouri, at the time that Black Lives Matter was becoming more and more a feature of how people understood the need to protest without cessation over the fact of police killings of people in this country. Young people, and people of all ages, I should say, in Ferguson, learned from people in solidarity in Palestine how to deal with tear gas. So that's just one example. There are other examples as well. But I think perhaps the heart of the question is, how can we reach through walls that seem to be so solid? You know, what are the modes of communication, of solidarity, of struggle that we can put into practice? And to come back to the U.S., and I'm not turning my back in any way on Palestine, a place I visited, gosh, 30 years ago, almost to the week, to talk about how some of the very small things that people do, if they're done persistently, start to add up to something bigger. So for example, to go back to that concept, survival pending abolition. The fact not only that people have worked very, very hard to create bail funds and other money resources to help people get out of being locked up, but also that people are sending care packages inside and sending them over and over and over again so that people who are inside who are not expecting to be bailed or to be released anytime soon can have some of what they need to safeguard their lives. And what comes with the care package is the fact of care. And this is not a small thing, it's a big thing. The solidarity is built in care. And I don't mean a kind of sentimental, although sometimes sentiment's okay, but a sentimental, oh, I care about you because you are needy. Because as I said at the beginning of our conversation, neither contempt nor pity is going to get us anywhere. Rather, the constant interactions that come from sending in care packages or teaching in a program or writing to people who are in occupied territories or being in solidarity with the women's artist group in Rio de Janeiro that is organizing the favelas against Bolsonaro on the one hand and the various paramilitaries on the other means that we build the kind of communication and trust, which is to say we know the people will be there again when we need them to do more.
We're out of time. I would like to thank Haymarket Books for granting us permission to share this audio, and also would like to thank Ruthie Gilmore. I would also like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Again, thank you for listening, and remember to stay safe.
Every second and fourth Saturday nights, midnight to 3 a.m. Sounds unsound. Sounds unsound. Sounds unsound. Only on Kaboo.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Patricia Kohlberg, your host for today.